Welcome to Conversations That Matter. This episode is brought to you by Odlum Brown, a client-focused investment firm that starts client relationships with straightforward conversations focused on you, your aspirations, and your investment priorities. Odlum Brown has been a supporter of Conversations That Matter from the day we started the show. Their only condition was that we provide a non-biased conversation with people from all sides of all sorts of issues. And of course, we couldn't produce this show without the support of Oh Boy Productions. And you. We need your support, so please pledge a dollar per show at patreon.com/conversationsthatmatter. Those dollars add up, and they play an important role in helping us produce the show. Now to this week's episode. When LNG Canada announced its final decision to go ahead with the massive LNG facility in Kitimat, it not only announced the largest industrial project in BC, it also demonstrated that industry and First Nations can find agreement in energy projects. The project meets a wide range of objectives that include, but are not limited to, the supply of natural gas to Asia, which needs it to replace coal in the production of electricity. Thousands of construction jobs will be created. And perhaps the most important component of the project is the model of engagement and agreement between natural resource producers and First Nations. The Haisla, where the plant will be built, and the elected councils of 20 First Nations that will host the pipeline that will deliver gas from the northeast of the province to the plant in Kitimat had to work together to develop long-term agreements. Chief Crystal Smith of the Haisla says, "This agreement provides us with jobs, opportunities for entrepreneurs, and resources to the community that allow her nation to take control of its destiny." We invited Susanna Pierce of LNG Canada to join us for a conversation that matters about the opportunity the liquefied natural gas project offers to the Haisla and the other partner First Nations, BC, and Canada.
Conversations That Matter is a partner program for the Centre for Dialogue at Simon Fraser University. The production of this program is made possible thanks to the support of the following and viewers like you.
Welcome.
Thank you.
The move towards LNG has been significant in the sense that it plays a very important role in the generation of electricity, especially in markets that are across the Pacific. Mm-hmm. What was the process that LNG Canada went through to determine that this would be the right place to make this investment? Because this is a big Mm-hmm. investment decision.
Yeah, it is. It's a huge investment. Well, I mean, the first thing to realize is that LNG Canada is made up of five joint venture partners. Mm-hmm. So you have your Shell, Petronas, Mitsubishi Corporation, China National Petroleum Company, as well as Korea Gas. And so if you actually take a look at each of those, what we call JVPs, each of them actually has their sense or their finger on the pulse of where supply and demand of energy resources are going. And in fact, some of those joint venture participants are actually consumers too. So when you take a look at China National Petroleum Company, mm-hmm. or you take a look at Korea Gas as one of the largest importers of LNG, not only are they involved in the LNG project here in Kitimat, but they're also responsible for making sure that their people in their countries have enough energy. Mm-hmm. Energy that actually also has to be cleaner than what it has been. And in particular, if you take a look at China and Korea, they have a very focused approach right now at two things. One, reducing greenhouse gas emissions, but two, and in particular, improving air quality. Mm-hmm. I think probably, as you know, on an annualized basis, about 7 million people die each year because of poor air quality. And so for China and Korea, they are very focused as countries on how do we improve that. So really, why Kitimat? Each of the joint venture participants recognize the need for natural gas to, again, displace more carbon-intensive forms of energy, improve air quality. But some of them also have substantial investments here in BC in the upstream where we produce the natural gas. So when you consider Shell with Groundbirch assets in the Montney, you consider Petronas, again, the largest single holder of Canadian natural gas reserves, I believe, in the country. They have a real interest of making sure they get that gas to a market. And so recognizing mm-hmm. the need for gas, recognizing where existing investments have been, but then also recognizing probably a third factor, which is when you look at where you get your gas supply as a consumer, you're interested in supply diversity. Why? Because you don't want to be beholden to one customer, one provider of that energy. And mm-hmm. so in this case, for the companies that are investing here, they see the diversity of Canadian supply as a nice and good bet when you're considering supply from other places like Russia are considering supply from other places in the Middle East. Canada is hopefully going to be that stable source of competitive natural gas supply that they can also depend on. So that's another consideration that I think in the minds of our joint venture participants made them decide that Canada was the right place to look. Getting to a final investment decision, well, that's another hurdle after that. Mm-hmm. Once you decided you want to look at Canada, getting to the process of making an FID is another hurdle, which, as you know, took some effort.
Well, it takes years.
It takes years.
Well, and there are so many components that are that come into play. Mm-hmm. You know, what's the jurisdictional attitude towards environment, taxes, what's the labor supply like, what about the expertise just in building the plant? We don't have that homegrown talent.
Yeah.
And so to pull all of those pieces together, in essence, you're saying, well, we're going to create this industry in British Columbia. And so was there something about British Columbia that makes us attractive for that, even though this is still a new sector for us?
Yeah, it's a great question, because what makes British Columbia attractive, quite frankly, is we've got a lot of gas here. You know, we have a lot of good, clean natural gas. And when I say clean natural gas, what I'm talking about is the way we produce it, but then also the fact that when I look at natural gas, for example, in the Montney gas basin, when I look at liquids rich, when I look at the carbon content, it's lower. Mm-hmm. So when you really consider, is this the type of gas that I can then produce, transport, and then bring into a market, it has lower CO2 right out of the gate. And so that's number one. Number two is the fact that it's, again, it's produced responsibly here. Across the entire world, when you look at sort of the environmental regulations and the benchmarks here in BC, we are world leading already. And so when you consider, is natural gas in BC a good place to produce? Yes, as a matter of fact, it is for those factors. But having a plant in BC where you produce the gas just makes perfect sense. And the fact that BC happens to be on the West Coast, where you're going to have your access 10 days sailing to the markets that are growing the fastest in demand for LNG, also just makes sense. So those were probably the first considerations. The next considerations, when we went through the process of where in BC, we actually at LNG Canada looked at more than 500 sites. We didn't actually go to 500 sites, but we did our desktop analysis, and then we went to numerous sites all the way up and down the coast, trying to find a site that allowed for us to have some key factors in place. Number one, when you're looking at where do you site an LNG facility, typically you want to look at where there's already an industrial development. Building it scratch in a green place where you have to do more to prepare the land to obstruct what is already there, mm-hmm. is probably not going to be your best bet.
Right.
So we were able to find a place that is an existing deepwater port, already zoned for industrial use. It's Kitimat, obviously, where mm-hmm. you had the former EuroChem pulp and paper mill, where you have the Rio Tinto aluminum smelter. So you're already in a jurisdiction which is industrial.
Right, and Methanex had been
and
there
Methanex,
as before,
of course.
Right?
Yeah, in fact, Methanex jetty too. So you have that factor working for you. And then I think the other key thing for you to recognize, as we did, is what are your relationships with the stakeholders going to be like? Do they actually want to consider something like this? And so developing those relationships with the Haisla First Nation, developing them with the community of Kitimat, developing it with the other nations actually further up the highway and further up the channel was also part of the preliminary work that we did to understand, is this the right place to site this project?
So I've got to get you to hang on for a second while we take a quick commercial break.
No problem.
We'll be right back. Conversations That Matter is an independent program that is produced thanks to the support of Odlin Brown. But we also need the support of people like you. And I encourage you to please go to patreon.com/conversationsthatmatter. And please check out our website, conversationsthatmatter.tv, and become a subscriber. There's a couple of different directions that we can go in here with this conversation, but you've led us to this point where I think is fundamentally important as we move forward in resource development in Canada. Post the Silcotine decision back in 2015, we now live in an environment where you will not move forward with resource development unless you have participation, not just consulting or agreement, but actual participation from those First Nations communities that are affected. And in many ways, we can take a look at the process that you have followed and say, okay, have you now created a blueprint that other organizations can look to. And so what I would like to do is say, well, what are the elements of ensuring that you are doing that, first of all, in a respectful manner, that you're working towards meeting the needs of individual communities? Because as you point out, the pipeline passes through 16 different communities from source through to the terminal. How do you then ensure that you're meeting the needs of those communities? And even still, it's going to have hiccups.
For sure. Well, you know, it's a very long and patient process. Mm-hmm. And that may not sound great if you're looking to develop a project very quickly as in a competitive environment you like to do, but it's the amount of time you spend up front, really with boots on the ground, understanding the interests and concerns, trying to find ways of reaching a place where together you can work towards an outcome that is mutually beneficial, is the approach that we took. Mm-hmm. And so in the case of LNG Canada, when we came to Kitimat, it wasn't after we'd gone through a process of deciding this was the right place. It was before we decided this was the right place that we engaged with the First Nations in the community.
So they were in essence, your first call?
Well, they were among our first calls, indeed. Yeah. You know, and it's where I think in our industry we've recognized that we can design the best projects technically, but technical design is not holding us up. We've learned this the hard way. What's holding us up is stakeholders willing to host, mm-hmm. or stakeholders feeling like they're getting a fair share. And I think that's fair. I think it's absolutely fair. We ought to be having everybody in the room talking about what's interesting and concerning to them so we can find a place where, yeah, we can agree we want to work towards this common outcome. And what was, I think, proof in the positive relationships we had developed is where you see when we went through the environmental permitting process, we had the community and First Nations actually working and advocating with us to mm-hmm. see these permits achieved. And as we go through construction, we see ourselves, again, finding opportunities to work together to overcome certain challenges that you'll face in a large construction project like this. So mm-hmm. I think the key ingredient of all of this is recognizing the importance of developing these relationships first, as we say on the project, developing relationships before you build the project. So you really design, you really build in the interests and concerns of your stakeholders and First Nations before you've got anything locked down. Mm-hmm. And then you can find yourself, in fact, saving time because you've done this preliminary work. And the strength and the resilience of the relationships in terms of they believe this is in their best interest to proceed has to be there. Mm-hmm. Because especially when you get into major construction projects like this, not everything's going to go right. And so if you haven't really built those relationships on that foundation of trust, then when stuff goes wrong, mm-hmm. you won't have a reasonable conversation. You won't have the trust to understand, look, this wasn't supposed to be the way that it was. So you've got to make sure the relationships are there.
How does that relationship continue to unfold beyond that initial process? Because mm-hmm. you say, okay, we're going to consult with you now. We're telling you what it is that we would like to propose. What are the issues that you have? Once you move beyond that, how detailed does that interaction become, and how like intrinsically connected to the project is it over the lifetime of the project?
Yeah, I think it's, and it's a great question, because I think these things have to be intrinsic over the lifetime of the project as much as they possibly can. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, when you consider going through an environmental permitting process, the process involves technical experts that represent your interests, they represent the First Nations' interests, you make sure that you have experts, obviously, through the regulatory authorities, so you have that level of detail and in-depth intrinsic knowledge so that you're actually looking at information together. As you go through construction, I think the one principle that I continue to live with, and I expect our project to continue to live with, is the concept of no surprises. I don't want our community and our First Nations or any of our stakeholders to learn about things unless we've told them about them. I don't want them to be surprised by some new information unless we've been at the table with them to let them know about it. And so we really do our best, and I make sure that when on our team we have the resources to do it, that we're always together, walking side by side. We're having the regular engagements. We're not leaving questions out into the open. We're answering the questions as quickly as we possibly can. That takes commitment, it takes resources, and it takes boots on the ground. The one thing where I've seen projects always fail is where they, one, don't have commitment, don't have resource, and don't have boots on the ground. Mm-hmm. If you don't have those three things, you'll never be successful, I think, in really developing partnerships and projects that continue to have the support in the local community that you really want to have.
This is our second break. Okay. We'll be back in a moment. Conversations That Matter is an independent program that is produced thanks to the support of Odlin Brown. But we also need the support of people like you. And I encourage you to please go to patreon.com/conversationsthatmatter. And please check out our website, conversationsthatmatter.tv, and become a subscriber. Many First Nations over the years have felt that, yes, okay, we get to this point, a project starts to move forward, but then where is the training, where are the jobs? Mm. And what's the commitment to ensuring that we're helping to create jobs? And I asked that question having had a conversation with Chief Counselor Crystal Smith and also with MLA Ellis Ross, who had been a previous Chief Counselor of the Haisla. And they point out that it's those jobs, it's access to self-actualization, the ability to make money, to be able to plan their own future,
for sure,
that gives them an opportunity to now change the quality of their lives.
Well, I think you're right to say it's training and jobs, because number one, the jobs that you need in the construction, the specific trades, you need to be trained for.
Mm-hmm.
So we, right out of the gate, actually, another unique thing I think about this project is we identified a workforce development manager, somebody whose sole purpose and sole being was to make sure that we had an understanding of the current capacity of the local community and the province to fulfill the trades jobs that we need, to identify the programs that we could invest in right out of the gate, either on our own or with partnerships like with the BC Construction Association, to make sure that we're focusing on the areas of need that we will need for these project and construction jobs.
And a lot of these are specialized jobs.
A lot of them
well,
are specialized jobs. And some of them are just your basic welding jobs or things like that. Not to say basic welding, because it's all not basic. But, you know, really focusing on where are the labor needs going to be? Where is the labor supply potentially going to be? What's some of that untapped supply, including with First Nations, with women, with youth? How do we focus on driving them into the trades? Putting real money into these investments and making real commitments, such as apprenticeships in construction, 25%, which we have, to make sure that the training is there to get people into jobs. The other thing is to make sure that you have the relationship, whether it's through agreement or whether it's through contracting opportunities, to make sure that First Nations are actually employed and working on site.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when I think about just the first couple of months that we had at LNG Canada, since we took FID, I think we had more than, 300 people working on site who were from the local community and were First Nations just right out of the gate. And that mm-hmm. was in part because we were able to selectively say, these are the jobs we're going to need. We want to make sure you have the training. And we have a commitment to hire local first before mm-hmm. we go anywhere else. So we're seeing it play out. But again, it takes recognition, as you have, that benefits to local communities are not just about getting a check. It's not just about tax revenue that you're going to pay anyway. We want to be a part of this project.
Mm-hmm.
And projects, quite frankly, want the community to be a part of the project, because then it's their project. It's not just ours. And that's, I think, more important for sustainable project development than anything else.
Mm-hmm. You talk about paying those taxes, though, but when you, I know that going early on into this, you made a financial commitment to these nations that are along the pipeline route and of course, the Haisla, and they're already starting to see a benefit. And one of the things that they point to in my conversation with those who have been in support of the project, already they're able to start putting money into cultural awareness programs. And from their perspective, this is a fundamental building block to ensure that as the community moves forward, it can take ownership, it can take pride in itself, its heritage, and then help and then build on that foundation to help people move forward and realize their own potential.
Absolutely. It's such an incredible thing when you sit down, as you have, and you spend time talking to these elected and hereditary chiefs who say that it's incredible to see for the first time that we have the freedom and the capacity to make our own choices, that we're not waiting for a check from the government, that we can actually have a long-term plan of development for our people, cultural awareness, drug and alcohol addiction mm-hmm. services. So these are things that they're actually for the first time having the wherewithal and the long-term ability to plan to see real change. And that is probably one of the most incredible experiences I have had, is to actually see this happening and see the words coming out of Chief Elected Councillor Crystal Smith saying, we're tired of managing poverty. We want to manage prosperity. And that's what they're doing. And I see that not only with the Haisla, I see it all the way through the channel, up in the inland. I see it along the pipeline too, where you see elected chiefs for the first time saying that this is really providing an opportunity mm-hmm. that we wouldn't otherwise have. And certainly, everyone would love to have no development whatsoever, but the world doesn't work that way. We have to have development
right.
in order to have jobs and in order to pay for the programs that are important to our people. So
mm-hmm.
that's, I think, one of the most inspiring outcomes of this entire process.
Third and final break. We'll be right back. Conversations That Matter is an independent program that is produced thanks to the support of Odlum Brown. But we also need the support of people like you. And I encourage you to please go to patreon.com/conversationsthatmatter. And please check out our website, conversationsthatmatter.tv, and become a subscriber. So I was up in Wet'suwet'en territory about a year ago and doing an interview with Irwin Tom, mm-hmm. Councillor Irwin mm-hmm. Tom. And he said, you know, 60 years ago, they put in a pipeline that runs through our territory right there. He said, we don't even have natural gas in our community right now. Mm-hmm. He says, I got to drive into town and get propane.
Yeah.
And he said, we don't get any revenue from that pipeline passing through here.
Mm-mm.
This time it's going to be different. You know, we are already starting to see a benefit from that. And you know, I'm going to wear my own bias on my sleeve here. This is what I want to see happen. Mm-hmm. I think that if we don't do this mm-hmm. As individuals, as corporations, and as a country, we're not going to be able to realize our potential collectively.
No.
Like, we have to have this kind of working together. That, I think, moves us much closer to a concept of reconciliation. But if nothing else, if it's creating opportunity for people who have been shut out,
mm-hmm.
then I'm in support of this. It takes me way off what I'm supposed to be doing. I'm not supposed to be talking
about it. Well, let me add to that.
But it matters to me.
It does matter to you. And let me tell you this. So this is one thing, too. So I will never speak for any of our First Nations leaders.
Right.
Or any of the nations that have made decisions to support the project, whether that's LNG Canada or the Coastal GasLink pipeline.
Yeah.
I will not speak for them. And that means that if they have gone through a process to make a decision to sign agreements, that should be legitimate and it should be recognized by all of us.
Right.
And that is how they speak to their position on that project. And that doesn't mean that you nor me or a bunch of white kids that have never been up there should be telling them what decisions are right or wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And that, for me, if you ask me what probably energizes me most, is how legitimate decisions made by legitimate councils, by elected chiefs with mandates, have been belittled by people who actually have never visited any of these regions,
mm-hmm.
who have never experienced the trauma and the challenge. And I will not speak for those chiefs mm-hmm. and those bands and those nations, nor should anybody else.
Well, I agree with you. And you and I, we know that it's not universally accepted. There is still some resistance. There's still work that has to be done. But clearly, LNG Canada is committed to this project because we're already hearing that the project may increase in scope.
Well, you know, I think LNG Canada is completely committed to phase one of this project.
Mm-hmm.
We are in construction.
Yes.
And it's fantastic. As I said, we've seen lots of employment and investment to date, locally and in the province. And then a future expansion of this project is really going to depend on how we do on phase one, making sure that we actually live up to the promise. And the promise is really making sure it's done safely, it's done on cost and on schedule. And then, of course, we live up to our commitments to First Nations and the local community, and we are that type of good corporate citizen in the province. And so our joint venture participants, as they did in this initial decision, they have a choice of where to invest. And they made a choice on this basis to invest in Canada and in BC. A future decision on an expansion will be up to them as well.
Mm-hmm.
And it will take into consideration, again, what's our track record, and what does it really look like for a future investment in this province and in this country? And since we're on the subject of investments, you know, for me, a very proud Canadian, it was a fantastic decision to make such an incredible investment here in Canada to get access to our natural resources that the world desperately needs, and we do develop the best. So that was profound. But what keeps me up at night when I think about global competition is that we remain competitive. And why does that matter? And that matters because in the absence of investments, we don't have the base to provide all those revenues that we would like to depend on for all these great social services we depend on here in Lower Mainland and all throughout the province. And so I think sometimes people forget the fact that investments drive revenues that are important to our way of life.
Mm-hmm.
In the absence of investments, because people don't believe it's a safe place to invest or they can't be competitive, we don't get them. The rest of the world gets them. And when we're thinking about natural resource development, I would add that the rest of the world doesn't do it as well. So when you consider investing in Canada, developing LNG Canada here, where we'll have the lowest carbon intensity of any project in the world, which means lower carbon emitted per ton of LNG produced.
Thanks for coming in. Thanks very much. Thank you.
Yeah.
And just before I go, I want to encourage you to subscribe to Conversations That Matter at conversationsthatmatter.tv. And please support us also on Patreon. One last thing, of course, check out oboy.ca for all your podcast and video production needs. In fact, if you want to suggest a topic, produce a video or a podcast, get in touch with the team at Oboy Productions. They'll work with you to produce a show just like this one that you can find at oboy.ca or conversationsthatmatter.tv. And finally, but most certainly not least, I want to give a shout out to Derek Hayter, Arnold Chang, and Greta Gibson. See you next time.